earth is on fire. We don't have no daughter. Let the mother earth burn.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard 1 week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. But first, some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
On March 13th, my attorney Richard Kerter appeared in federal court for argument before U.S. District Judge Benita Y. Pearson. The hearing related to an injunction request my attorney filed, in part to stop state terrorists from blocking my protected communication, specifically prison fascists blocking my video visit to stop me from posting video online. State terrorists have lied to justify their repression. They claim that I threatened to burn down the Ohio State House, which is something I've never done. But I really did. I promised to legalize burning down the Ohio State House if and when elected Ohio governor. Threatening to burn down the State House and promising to legalize its burning are two very different things, just like it's two very different things if you threaten to fly a plane into someone else's building or if you plan to demolish your own. Still, I was informed that Judge Pearson took issue with my position, and that she wasn't happy to hear that I wouldn't apologize for my statement. All due deference to Judge Pearson, I would suggest that if she disagrees with my position, and if she lives in Ohio, she should probably not vote for me. Instead, she should vote for one of two deluded hierarchs who really ought to apologize for all of their campaign promises. They promised to continue a 6,000-year failure, despite all available data that screams that hierarchy hasn't worked. At any rate, I'm hopeful that Judge Pearson won't use her personal disagreement with my thoughtful and irrefutably reasonable position as an excuse to give prison fascists the free license to continue terrorizing me and silencing me. I hope she can empathize with my plight and recognize my right to advocate positions that she herself may find disagreeable. The reason I haven't apologized for my position on the Ohio State House is, I'm not sorry. I have no problem apologizing when I'm sorry, when I'm regretful, when an error in my judgment is brought to my attention. In those instances, I'm quick to apologize. For the record, I make lots of mistakes, more than anyone else I know. But I only make the same mistake once, and I take great pride in my mistakes, as those are learning experiences. Mistakes are all the things we do until we get something right. So my huge number of mistakes testifies to my stubbornness to get things right. But I'm incapable of apologizing just to tell others what they want to hear, to manipulate others, to get my own way. I'm not that kind of scoundrel. I'm a different kind of scoundrel altogether. So until someone presents to me some reasonable argument for the Ohio State House's utility and its legality, I'm still of the mind that we're better off without it, and I'm incapable of pretending otherwise, even if it means a federal judge will give prison fascists permission to start torturing me again. If they're going to terrorize me and silence me until I'm sorry, they're going to need to get some chips and beer, because we're going to be here a while. But having said that, I don't want to be intransigent, so I'm willing to meet the so-called state of Ohio halfway. I'll apologize for my position that we're better off burning down the Ohio State House if the state of Ohio apologizes for violating the Treaty of Greenville, for illegally colonizing and occupying unceded Indian territory, and for illegally erecting the Ohio State House in the middle of it. And I'll apologize for my Ohio State House position. If the state of Ohio apologizes for distributing smallpox-infected blankets to tribal children, deliberately exterminating hundreds of thousands in the first recorded instance of biological warfare, an event that Hitler praised in his book Mein Kampf. So if the state of Ohio apologizes for building the state house on the corpses of innocent thousands, I'll apologize for advocating its destruction. Also, I'll apologize for my state house position if the state of Ohio apologizes for framing and imprisoning skilled workers, deliberately using them for slave labor to build the state house on the cheap, cutting corners on worker safety, and letting dozens of framed citizens fall to their deaths. So if the state apologizes for sacrificing human lives and erecting their idol, I'll apologize for saying it should be destroyed. And finally, I'll apologize for my state house petition if the state of Ohio peacefully dissolves itself and thereby proves I can exercise my right to abolish the government, a right that's recognized by Article 1, Section 2 of the Ohio Constitution, and that we can abolish the government without torturing the state house. So there you have it. I'm not unreasonable. I have no problem apologizing. In fact, I sincerely hope the state of Ohio creates the condition to make my honest apology possible. That could be incredibly cathartic. But knowing these state sociopaths intimately, I would recommend that Judge Pearson shouldn't hold her breath. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address at seanswain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route, number 728, Lucasville, Ohio, 45699. To read some of Sean's writing and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
First of all, could you introduce yourselves for the radio and tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you do?
We should decide who's going to go first.
I'm Emily Horn, and I am a photographer and designer and occasional editor of books. Probably most significantly right now, I make a long-running webcomic called A Softer World with a writer named Joey Comeau. So that is what I do.
Had you ever written any books before this, or is this your first?
No! I was sort of terrified of writing, in fact. But I had done a bunch of editing projects. And the way that we split up the work for this book was often, there was often a lot, like there was writing and then there was editing other people's writing and adding to it, which is a lot less terrifying if you are a person who's not used to writing. Also, I just did a master's degree a couple of years ago, so that kind of ramps up your writing skills again. So,
My name is Tim Malley. I am mostly a writer and journalist. My background is in philosophy. Right now I'm teaching industrial design at the Rhode Island School of Design and doing more writing. The other thing that I should say is, so I write about design and architecture. I'm particularly interested in thinking about architecture and design at scales that are much larger than normally is considered design. So this project is sort of one example of that, but like this summer I'm going to be running a conference about landscape architecture at the scale of continents.
Can you talk about, or we're talking about your book, The Inspection House, an Impertinent Guide to Modern Surveillance. Did I get that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Can you, and that book came out last year?
October 2014.
Can you talk a little bit about what led you to write this book and talk a little bit about who your ideal audience would be?
You want to start on this one, Tim?
Sure, I'll start. So Emily and I have been friends for, oh God, a long time. And basically we met in university and we really liked hanging out with each other in class. And we started doing this thing where we would, whenever possible, be in the same class and then convince the professor to let us write a joint paper. And so one class about visual culture, we decided to look at surveillance. And so the way we thought we would do that is we would go to a local mall. So this is in like 1997 or 8 or something. So it's before September 11th. But we went to a local mall and decided to just take a picture of every security camera we could find, which is an excellent way to get the attention of mall security, which we then parlayed into an interview. And so that was sort of our first joint encounter with surveillance and being really curious about it and how it works. So we had this really great interview with the guy who was the head of mall security. Like we turned the what are you kids doing here into actually one of the most successful projects we did together, I think. Flash forward many years, and Emily and I have lived in different cities at different times, but we were back living in the same city. And Had just finished doing a project about border towns. We ran a summer-long design studio just for anyone who is interested, so architects and artists and writers who wanted to spend a summer thinking about designing people who design for or live in or live with border towns. So can we look at them as architectural spaces or design spaces? And that was done, and we were deciding if we wanted to do another project together. And then Coach House, who was the publisher, approached me and said, hey, have you ever thought about pitching a book? And so Emily and I went and pitched them a book about border towns that was very ambitious, that they loved, and were like, and we can't do that on any quick timeline. And sort of like as the meeting was about to end, I don't even remember which of us said it first. So Emily, you maybe can jump in.
Yeah. So at the end of the meeting, we started talking about an article that Tim had just written that was a sort of really weird look at Foucault through this conversation, a sort of fictionalized version of a real life conversation that he had had with this guy in cottage country in Northern Ontario. And so it was an interesting way of looking at contemporary surveillance and Foucault's Discipline and Punish, which both of us had read in university. And we ended up during that meeting sort of spinning that idea out into a book, which would be part of Coach House's Exploded Views series, which is what this book ended up being. So it's a short book, and we were able to go from having our initial meeting to finishing the book within 12 months.
That's awesome. That's quite a speedy turnaround time. Had you all been thinking about this book beforehand? I mean, it seems like you had been.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's hard not to think about surveillance right now. That has been true for a long time. And it's gotten harder and harder not to think about surveillance. So in that way, it was around. I mean, it had been a long time since either of us had read or thought about these things in a, like, concentrated, semi-academic kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a rigorous sort of way, but I think it was going on in the background for a long time.
And certainly, if you're going to do a 9-week project about designing for border towns, mm-hmm. like, you inevitably are going to spend a bunch of time thinking about how borders are policed, which these days involves a lot of, obviously, surveillance. So it was like, there's like a thematic.
Should we talk about the Niagara Falls?
Yes, we should.
That was crazy.
So we were living in Toronto at the time that we did this. We ran the studio in Toronto. So Niagara Falls is very close. It is a very popular tourist destination and a really weird town. But it turns out that if you like call people up and like, hi, we're just interested in things, can we come have a tour? And you get the right person that they will invite you and show you stuff. And so we got to see the offices of, what's the name of the commission?
The Niagara Bridge Commission, I think is what they're called. This never occurred to me before we started talking to this guy, but it turns out that all of those bridges are owned by someone. They're not just taken care of by the city, the county, or what have you. So this is a company that runs, I think, 3 border bridges across the river between New York State and Southern Ontario.
And so we were like, hey, we'd love to talk a little about what it is like to manage the architecture that connects two countries. Like, how more architecturally border towny could you be than 3 bridges that connect two cities into one city? What we didn't expect was that the guy was going to be like near retirement and just totally enthusiastic about what they do. And so it turned into him being like, yeah, come on in and we'll stand around in a conference room for 20 minutes and I'll tell you a bit about what we do. And now let me take you to the room where all of the cameras feed to. It's like weird high-tech from the movies-esque wall.
Yeah, it has
of
a sort of like Bond villain kind of feel to it. And so there are 3 sets of cameras on the bridges that are by different organizations. So the Canadian Border Services will have a set of cameras. These bridges have 3 sets of cameras on them. They have a set run by Canadian Border Services, and they have a set run by Homeland Security in the States, and they have a set run by the company that owns these bridges. So what we were seeing is the control room for all of the cameras on all 3 of the bridges that this company owned.
And they were really, really proud of them. Their reasoning is like, look, if terrorists wanted to mess up Niagara Falls, this is where you'd do it, right? You'd cut these 3 links and blow up a bridge, and that would be a spectacular event and whatever else. So that was part of it. But then the other like huge benefit of having all these cameras is that it made it really easy for people with Nexus passes, which allow you to cross, because you pre-screened and then allows you to cross. And so these Nexus pass people, there's one bridge dedicated to them. So if you have that special pass, you can cross this bridge and you have no border check because you've been pre-screened. So there's like two tiers of access to crossing. And all of these automated systems allow the Nexus cars to just drive through without getting stopped and checked, right? And so the user experience for Nexus holders is that the border goes away, whereas for the rest of us who haven't been pre-screened, the border is still there. And the way that the border goes away for the users who have been pre-screened is by tripling the amount of surveillance there to make sure it was really them that drove through.
That's so interesting because it seems to me like it would create a weird like class dynamic within like border surveillance. And I know that the TSA does that something. They have these little clear frequent flyer TSA cards that you just basically wave at the TSA agent and you get to sail right through any sort of security or whatever. And that's so interesting that that happens at Niagara Falls too. Like I didn't think about that at all.
Yeah, between Canada and the States, there's the Nexus Pass, and then between Mexico and the States, it's called something different.
Sentry. Yeah.
Like, even in the name.
Well, I feel safer.
Even in the name, you can tell the difference about the relationship between America and the Mexico border.
No, but it's Sentry. It's Sentry with an I that makes it cute.
That's better. I would buy that. Sure.
Cute and non-threatening.
Right. Although, like, I got to say, in terms of, like, a different class dynamic, the bigger difference, I mean, Nexus, like, is lovely if you have it. I don't. But the bigger difference in dynamic is whether you take the bus to cross the border, a car to cross the border, or a plane to cross the border. And if you have the money, I recommend taking a plane, because you are treated way better most of the time when you fly. A car is also generally pretty good, but if you are on a bus, the most people having the most problems crossing the border that I've experienced, like seen happen, has been when I've been taking the bus across the border.
I would imagine also like exists within a class dynamic as well, because the bus is like generally cheaper and generally more accessible to folks.
Absolutely.
So
yes, that's exactly it, right? Like, so it's not like there's an official policy, probably, but it's just sort of the fact that you are on a bus appears to result in a higher degree of attention being paid to you.
That's so interesting that happens there too. I feel like I could talk in this vein for a while, but moving on to the next question. Since this is an anarchist radio show, would you like briefly describe your political leanings, if any?
No
pressure.
my partner is a PhD student in cultural studies. And when I started hanging around with his friends a couple of years ago, I noticed that one of the first things people ask him is what are you, politically speaking? And generally, there's a sort of a pretty narrow spectrum between Marxist and anarchist and some various combinations of the two. So I think I was sort of happy to be able to look at myself. I think I don't need to define myself.
I feel like I exist in a community where defining yourself politically was not terribly important. So it was interesting to be exposed to politically minded grad students who were very inclined to define themselves by particular political leanings, and often in extremely specific ways. And I guess the only other answer I have to this question, which is maybe a tiny bit glib, but maybe not, is I live in Toronto now, and our paper, The Star, a few weeks ago had a sort of political quiz. It was quite involved, and you would have to say how you felt about a number of issues, and they would place you in within 8 or 10 different categories. And the one that it gave me was post-materialist left. So it's maybe not the most nazzy of names, but that's where they placed me on the political spectrum.
Do you agree with that? Like, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, actually. I mean, I think one of the main differences between that identification and others is the belief that inequality comes from social structures. And I very strongly agree with that notion.
As an anarchist, me too. I do agree with that. Tim, do you have a an answer to that too?
Yeah, so I don't even hang out with people who define themselves politically first. Like, in the last few years, I've ended up, the things that I've been doing the most in the past few years has been tech and design journalism, which means mostly interviewing and talking to people who are very much engaged in trying to understand and work with and benefit from the machinery of capitalism, or being at places like Harvard, where there's people doing a lot of work about society and whatever else, but not explicitly defining themselves in these clear ideological ways, right? It's the ideologies of when you're close enough to the mainstream that you don't think you need to tell yourself that you have an ideology. I mean, in my life, I've sort of run all over the place. I think that things are not working very well right now for a lot of very interesting ways, and I'm extremely suspicious of agendas that think that by simplifying and starting over, that would solve the problems that we face. I think that we are beset by wicked problems, which is like a term of art for problems that have no, that are not actually solvable in the sense that, like, you can be like, I didn't have enough water, and so then I went and I got some water. That's not a wicked problem. But, like, the world we live in is spiraling towards, or possibly in the middle of, a climate catastrophe, and we only get one shot at fixing it, and no one can agree about what fixing it would look like. So we're beset by those kinds of things, and so I worry when I encounter both anarchist and libertarian approaches of me, like, oh, we should, like, a revolution would solve this. Like, if only we got rid of all of this, these complications, then it would solve it. But the systems that are in place, for better and worse, are there because they're pretty resilient. They're not resilient enough, and they don't necessarily promote resilience for the people who live inside of them. But the systems themselves are actually extremely resilient, which gives me pause.
I like the term, I've never heard the term wicked problem before, and that seems to be really evocative in this way. Then that feels really nice, or that feels really real.
Oh yeah, look up wicked problems, they're super interesting.
It's interesting, like revolutionary anarchism is something that feels to me, I mean, I'm 30 years old, like I've been an anarchist since I was 18, basically, seems to me to be something that's fairly dated. And mm-hmm. something that, like, very much came out of, like, 60s and 70s anarchist activism or mm-hmm. whatever. But, like, and I don't really think that within, like, anarchist thought right now, revolution is something that people are really talking about. I really could be mistaken because it's such a thing that is, like, based in self-determination.
Right.
But, and there's so many different kinds of anarchism.
Like, there's an extent to which my ignorance betrays my ability to have a coherent position about anarchism one way or the other, that I would feel confident that I believed, right? Like, I don't know enough of contemporary anarchist theory in order to say that I disagree with contemporary anarchist theory.
Word. I would call that a, like, fairly universal human condition. Not to be a jerk. I'd love to get along to a discussion about the book itself. I really, really enjoyed it. And one of the book's major structural themes, it seems, is a comparing and contrasting of Jeremy Bentham's The Panopticon writings and Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish. Would you both talk about this choice and touch on the overall themes of the book?
So when we first pitched this project, I don't think we were looking at it in exactly this way. I don't think we thought that Bentham was going to be such a big part of the project. So I'll just give you what we talk about in our introduction as a quick way of explaining how the book works. So we have seven longer chapters and several small asides and mini chapters kind of sprinkled throughout the book. And what we're doing is, in each chapter, we're examining a specific site of surveillance, whether that is a physical site or not. And in each case, we are using Foucault and Bentham and the sites to kind of explain one another.
Yeah, I think your recollection is the same as mine. I'm just looking at the shared drafts folder that we used, and that we originally called the project hashtag Foucault. The original pitch was, we're going to, okay, it's been like 40 years, actually it's been literally 40 years now, since Discipline and Punish was released. It is still thought to be one of the like most important texts about surveillance, but a lot's happened in the last 40 years. So what kind of lessons or what might we learn by using the kind of approach that Michel Foucault takes, which is a sort of on this, is an allegedly, we can talk about this in detail if you want, but Foucault is a characterized often and writes like he's an architectural thinker, right? So he talks a lot about buildings and structures and the way that they shape. So what if we looked at contemporary architectures and then looked at what Foucault was talking about and looked for clues about, like, to what degree did what he was writing about show up? And to what degree have things changed in ways that he didn't expect? So that was the original pitch. And then we were like, well, his book is a book about Bentham's book. So the name Panopticon and the image of the Panopticon, Foucault is taking from Bentham's proposal. So we should probably like take a look at Bentham's proposal too. We'll just quickly read it. It's not very long, right? Because Bentham wrote 21 letters. He wrote the book as a series of letters to his father, somebody.
His father, yeah.
Yeah, to his father. So he's like, dear dad, I have just thought of a way that prison should be built.
Actually, I stole the idea from my brother. But anyway.
please see the next 20 letters. So yeah. We're like, oh, we'll just read it in, and then we'll get on to Foucault. But then it turns out that, so Bentham's writing at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, right? It's the late 1700s. And it's also, as Foucault would argue, the dawn of contemporary penal systems. And it turns out that those two things are intimately related in a way that I was not aware of before, like, rereading Bentham. And so when what we all wanted to do on the far end was like look at places, the story I'd internalized about Foucault was he takes this metaphor of this particular way of making a prison and he sees that way of making a prison in all of these different contemporary institutions. But actually, that wasn't some big leap on his part. That was Bentham's plan. And Bentham spends the last chapter or the last second last chapter or something near the end of his book proposing all these other institutions where this system of surveillance and power could work. So then Bentham ends up being our creepy godfather, like our weird crank. He's such a strange guy. I mean, do you know that his body, his stuffed and preserved body, is on display in England?
I had heard that, and I'm so delighted to have that corroborated by you. I also heard, as a like weird rumor about Jeremy Bentham, that he's wheeled into board meetings and he gets the deciding vote. Also that his head has been stolen a number of times by like university students or something.
So his head has definitely been stolen a number of times by the university students that exist. So the auto icon, which is him encased in glass, has a wood or wax, I can't remember which it is, fake head. But then his actual head, mummified, leathery head, for a while used to sit between his legs, but university students kept stealing it. So they've now taken his actual head and they've put that away, but the rest of the auto icon is still there. I've also heard the rumor that he is the deciding vote at the Royal Society, but I haven't corroborated or unproven it one way or the other. And Emily, have you either?
No, I don't know if there's any if there's any real evidence about that. But there has been actually a new interesting development in the auto icon, and that is, I think last week they installed a camera at the top of the box in which
you're
the auto
kidding.
Icon sits. I am not kidding.
That's so cute.
Oh my god.
Yeah, so if people want to try and look it up, it's at University College London and it's called the Auto Icon, and now there is a camera on it, and you can see who is standing in front of the auto icon and who is being given a tour of it, etc. at any given time, which is too perfect for words.
It can be your own Jeremy Bentham live cam.
Yeah, except you can't see him. You can see people looking at him.
Oh.
So it's the sort of...
That's almost better.
...eye of Jeremy Bentham himself. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, certainly thematically much closer to the dream of the Panopticon, right?
For sure. We're speaking with Emily Horn and Tim Malley about their book, The Inspection House, and discussing Jeremy Bentham and his life. Will you describe Jeremy Bentham as a person And yeah, I was totally surprised to learn that he was an avid feminist, because he's such a creepy godfather, like you said. But yeah. Can you talk about him?
So he's born in London, and he lived there for most of, if not all of, the rest of his life in the 1740s sometime. He's a prodigy child. He's discovered reading like incredibly complex books when he's a toddler. He goes to university at 12, and his father is a lawyer or a judge or something along those lines. He wants his kid to go into law to follow him. So Jeremy starts on that path, but it turns out that he's more interested in critiquing the law than performing it. So a lot of his early writings, I guess, especially, are law-related and law reform-related. And you can sort of see where talking about prison reform really fits in with the rest of what he's doing. So he was writing the Panopticon letters when he was in his late 30s, early 40s, something around then. So it's pretty relatively early in his career. So he basically becomes a gentleman intellectual. His father dies, and so he doesn't have that pressure to go into the law anymore, and leaves him a pile of money. And so he can devote his life to writing, and writing about whatever pleases him. Politically speaking, he gets more radical the older he gets, which I think is probably slightly unusual. I don't think that's the way we usually think about people's political leanings changing as they age anymore, but that's certainly what happened to him. So I think most of his writing, his feminist writing, he advocated for universal suffrage. He wanted to decriminalize homosexuality. And these were all extremely radical positions at the time. He is living in this time of incredible change. And he is very influenced by a lot of the other Enlightenment and utilitarian thinkers at the time, in Britain especially. So knowing a bit about his background kind of tells you where he's coming from. He wants to solve these problems that he sees in the world. And one of the ways that he sees to do that is to change the architecture, because that will change the behavior of the people who live within it.
So very much a utopian thinker, it seems.
Oh, yes, very much so. But, well, no, actually. He's proposing... So the Panopticon letters are just such a wild ride to read, because he will slide between sort of making the like biggest pronouncements about human nature to working out in fine detail the mechanisms for a rope and pulley system that would allow guards in the tower to communicate with prisoners, right? So the proposal for a panopticon, although he has these big ideas about how it could be applicable everywhere, he really wanted to build one. And he devoted a good chunk of the end of his life to trying to get one built and then suing the British government when a whole bunch of things failed. So he's a utopian thinker in the way that a Silicon Valley VC capitalist or startup CEO is a utopian thinker. They promise that they're going to change the world, but they really think they can do it. And they're not wrong. They may be wrong about exactly how the world's going to change, but they're not wrong about their idea that the things that they are trying to do could change the world. So he doesn't see the Panopticon as like a dream or something. He really sees it as something that can and should be built.
Gotcha. I realize that like we've been talking a lot about Jeremy Bentham and the Panopticon, but we haven't actually, for those listeners who aren't familiar with the notion of a Panopticon, would you all take a stab at describing it and its intended uses? And it also seems to me to have been like ultimately a failed endeavor on Bentham's part to actually build one of these, based on what I remember of your book. And it seems to be more in use as like a social model than physical space. Is that totally off the mark?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And that's where Foucault's influence comes in, right? So Foucault took this very practical idea of Bentham's, which was worked out in its tiniest detail, and turns it into a metaphor that you can use to look at whatever structures or institutions in the world that you want to use it to look at. So to get back to the structure itself, this is the part where Jeremy Bentham's brother comes in. His brother Samuel, who was quite a bit younger than him in the 1780s, was working for Potemkin in Russia, and he was a naval architect, but he was tasked with overseeing a bunch of factories. So the idea there was, this industrial revolution was happening in Western Europe, and Russia wants to have an industrial revolution as well, but in order to do that, you need to bring in people who are specialized and know how to run a factory, which is not something that is an automatic skill. So Samuel Bentham and a number of other people were brought in to help run these factories in Russia. And Samuel is another kind of inventor guy. He has a lot of wild ideas and he wants to make them real. And one of his ideas was a factory floor where the supervisor is sitting or living actually in a tower in the center of a circular factory floor so that he, and obviously it's going to be a he, is able to watch not only the workers, but the supervisors of those workers who tended to be kind of unruly British guys who were brought in because of their expertise, but were not maybe the best workers. So that was where the original idea came from. But it was Jeremy Bentham who visited his brother, heard about this idea, and decided it would be well suited for not just factories, but also prisons.
So we should say exactly what it is, which is, so the basic idea is, you make a building that's in the shape of a ring. You set it up so that the ring consists of a series of rooms, each of which is exactly the width of the ring. So every part of the ring has one room. You build a tower in the middle, and you make it so that from that tower, you can see into each of the rooms. So someone standing in the middle can just do a quick 360, and they can look into every single room. So you use bars or today you would use glass or whatever to make it so that you can see that. For the tower itself, you set up a clever system of shutters and doors so that from the ring, the people in the rooms in the ring cannot see into the tower. And they cannot see one another because the walls between them. So that then architecturally creates the power dynamic that Bentham wants, which is people in the rooms or in the cells could be being watched at any time, and they know they could be being watched at any time, but they cannot know at any given moment whether they are being watched. Meanwhile, the people in the tower can look anywhere they want or could not even be there, but because you could potentially be being watched when you're in the cells, you have to assume that you're being watched, and so you will behave as though you're being watched, which means that you will, Jeremy thinks, behave well.
One of the really important notions here is this, like a lot of other industrial revolution ideas, is supposed to be a labor-saving device. So if you have this system set up such that the prisoners are monitoring their own behavior, you don't have to have as many guards. And if your guards are all in the central tower and they can look into any of the rooms or cells whenever they like, there doesn't need to be as many of them as if you had in other prison systems. You would have to, you know, walk down a hallway and check inside each cell. So that's going to take more time. So the whole idea here is to save money and run this prison in the most efficient way that you can.
That seems so demonic, but it's so fascinating that he kind of got into his own head and got into other people's head to such a degree that he was like, people are going to watch themselves if they think they're being watched at all times. And I think that like that really resonates with how modern surveillance has really changed within the past 5 years, but certainly within the past decade of phone tapping and all this media stuff about you're being watched at all times and this conversation is being monitored right now and, you know, don't, you know, all of this stuff, and creates the perfect cop in your head in a way.
Mm-hmm. And like, it's worth pointing out, right, so that we can connect this, because you're not the first person who, when having a panopticon described to them, says like, that sounds demonic. So we should briefly like just connect that guy, the guy who invents that, to the feminist universal suffrage, remove the ban on homosexuality, vegetarian, utilitarian, liberal thinker. And the connection is probably, or the best connection is, it was an improvement on the alternative, right? Because the things that were happening in prisons before the Panopticon were like dungeons and people in chains, and the jailers could abuse their charges without any kind of consequence, and it was very hard for the judiciary to check and make sure that people were being cared for appropriately, and prisons were just a terrible place to be anyway. So Bentham's idea is that this is a better, more humane way to make run a prison.
Do you think that any like enduring good things have, I mean, yeah, I hear that like prison used to be super, super bad and dungeons and all that stuff. And though, like, I don't think that I would feel comfortable making an argument that like prisons are like a good thing or anything like that. And I don't think the book does either. It seems to take a really even keel on that question. But do you think there's been any enduring good things that have come out of these Panopticon writings or anything like that?
So, I mean, my first answer is the reason we bring up Bentham's very good intentions is not to defend the Panopticon, but to sort of sound an alarm bell for good intentions. That good intentions are not enough when you're redesigning systems. That very well-intentioned, like this guy's super well-intentioned, systems can still result in extraordinarily oppressive structures. And that's Foucault's one of his big contributions is it doesn't matter what the individuals want within this system. If the system works well, right? If it's constructed in the way that Bentham wants it to be constructed, then its consequences are pretty terrible. So that's my first answer. How about you, Emily?
Well, the thing is, it mostly exists as an idea rather than an object, because Bentham failed at getting his Panopticon built. One of the sort of mini sidebars that we have in the book is a list of prisons and asylums that have been called Panoptic at one time or another. But the thing is, if you look carefully at each one, they all fail in terms of what Bentham would have wanted for them. Many of them are circular, so they have that similarity to the Panopticon design. The prison that's on the cover of our book is Stateville in Illinois.
Yeah, that's right.
That one's been around since the early 20th century. And people look at it as being Panoptic, but while it does have the central guard tower and the circular structure, it doesn't isolate people the way that Bentham wanted to isolate people. And I think there are a number of other ones that sort of fail, in quotes, to realize his ideas. Now, I think if he had been around now, he would be delighted at the technological possibilities of the kinds of surveillance that we have. He had to design these sort of arcane systems of lights and grates so that the prisoners could not see the guards in the tower. But it's very easy for us to do that now. We can install a camera, or there's a prison in the Netherlands that has bracelets or anklets or something on all of their prisoners, and those prisoners are allowed to roam where they will within the prison during the day, but they're confined to their cells, which they share with other people at night. So certainly some of his ideas have seeped into the way that prisons are run today, and I think he would be delighted to see the possibilities that technology provides. But that's another cautionary tale, right? He's looking at architecture to solve our problems, and I think the tendency now is to look at technology to solve our problems. I don't think that answers your question either. But
here's the complex thing to understand about surveillance is that what you think about it will very much depend on what the power dynamics are and which side of them you are on and which side of them a better world is on,
mm-hmm,
right? Like,
for sure.
Do I want a more effective, more oppressive system of jails? No, I think probably our jails are plenty oppressive. Probably they should be less oppressive. Mm-hmm. And Bentham would argue that today's jails, part of why they suck is because, right, like Florida has this ridiculously high rate of prisoner deaths in jails. Bentham would say, well, yeah, because you've made these jails where guards can abuse prisoners. So if you had jails where the public could come in and see whether or not prisoners were being treated well easily, you wouldn't have, like, this kind of murder and abuse couldn't happen. And similarly, you know, like, I would like greater visibility, mm-hmm, into things that governments do. You got to separate flow of information from surveillance culture and surveillance structures. And Bentham has some stuff to say there. So the other thing, like the Panopticon project brought into the world, is the ability to talk about these things, right? Mm-hmm. Bentham gave us a vocabulary for understanding why just a different flow of information that, mm-hmm, like, one group of people gets to know more than the others and how that can impact their relationship. That gives us something to talk about so that we can kind of understand, why is it so bad to have so many security cameras? What is the answer to the, well, if you have nothing to hide, why do you care? And being able to look at this stuff that Bentham was talking about and see how we thought it would work and see how it actually works helps us to understand and resist some of those structures. So it's not the thing that he wanted to bring into the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know.
That's super interesting, the question of, yeah, well, if you have nothing to hide, then what? And I think that your comments just now ties pretty perfectly into like one of the next questions I'd like to ask, which is, or comment and then question, is one of my favorite things about what I've read of Foucault, which isn't very much, is his discussion of the diffuse nature of power. Mm-hmm. And you guys have a really good quote about power near the end of the book. In the there's the last chapter is on like iPhones, and you sort of dissect iPhone surveillance. Mm-hmm. The quote goes, "And though it is convenient to conceive of power as a monolith, it is not. Our phones are one user interface of the huge network that is required to make such surveillance possible. Global positioning satellites, RFID tags, drones, and CCTV cameras are the other physical points on this network, and a great deal more exists only in virtual space, i.e. vast warehouses of computation, located wherever power is cheap and or internet is fast. This network is populated by a riot of factions and powers with interests sometimes aligned and sometimes at odds. In our very small way, we too are nodes in this network, watching and being watched." And that tied into your discussion of the theater of surveillance was really, really interesting, and ties also directly back into like the psychological impacts of thinking that you're being watched at all times. Do y'all feel able to tackle that for a little bit?
What we wanted to do with the last couple of chapters, because I think we started to feel like the experience of reading the book might feel oppressive to people. So with the last couple of chapters, we are trying to incorporate this idea of Foucault's that power does not simply operate from those with power to those without it, that it is a diffuse thing that exists in the world and self-known through networks and power relations that run both up and down and between people of the same sort of what you might call level of power. So we finished the book by talking about our phones, because those act as vectors of surveillance in both directions. And sure, we're being watched by governments, but those aren't the only people who are watching us. This is moving in many different directions at all times. So I think that's what we wanted to do with the last couple of chapters, where we talk about Occupy Oakland and some of their tactics that they used to confound surveillance that was happening to them, and with the iPhone chapter as well.
I liked it because it definitely lends a sort of really human level or human aspect, I guess, to the notion of power not being as this, you know, like fuck the state or whatever. Like, it lends a lot of nuance to it, and that's why I liked that quote particularly.
Yeah, I think like the nuance thing was really important to us, partly because like it is very easy to sort of blanket dismiss things, and it's also very easy when you spend too many hours in a row contemplating the scale of the variety of situations that you might not like or think should exist to end up being like, oh well, I guess we're done. Like, what can we do about all of that? And it really is very like, you know what, like, okay, so we're writing a book in 12 months about a topic that have been somewhat experienced in, but that we haven't done a lot of research in. And like each of our ridiculous chapters is multiple other people's entire academic careers, right? Like the question of what is going on with, you know, iPhone surveillance or iPhones, like how are mobile devices changing the world. Like, there are like entire schools devoted to new media and understanding that kind of stuff, right? But we're like, oh, we'll write it in a month. It'll be fine. So what do we bring to the table, and what do we bring that is different from, like, that will be still relevant? So the other weird thing about writing a book to both of us who publish online often is that, like, how is what we're writing today going to be relevant in a year? Because this book is out there and it's going to sit there in the world. We put our pens down almost a year ago now, and it hasn't even been launched in Canada yet, right? Like, not officially. We're doing the tour this coming week. So what I think, and Emily, you can tell me if you agree with this, but I think what we wanted to try to bring in was, like, to spend a bunch of time asking people to sit in the ambiguities and to sit in the, like, weird, nuanced spaces, and to, like, find, hopefully, some kind of better way of thinking about these things in those gaps. I hope that's what we did.
I definitely...
And it was like, no, I just wanted people to be mad about drones.
We hardly talk about drones at all.
That's true, we don't.
I think that was maybe one of the only places that you talked about drones in the book, and I found it. So
I got to tell you, like, that chapter was the funniest chapter to write, because we were writing it during the summer of Snowden, right? So
that's brutal.
As we were writing the book, so most of the previous chapters are about things that happened in the past, right? So things where, like, the history is well established. Like, a first chapter is about a failed attempt to build a prison in the 1790s and early 1800s. So, like, okay, like, that's settled, you know, and then, like, some of the other stuff was about Guantanamo Bay, and that's, I mean, still happening, but, like, the key parts that we want to talk about happened 10 years ago and 5 years ago, it was settled. But the iPhone chapter, literally every 3 days, some new article is being posted on one of the major newspapers revealing some new aspect to contemporary electronic surveillance. We're like, I guess that is a new thing that is true that we should incorporate somehow. And, like, you're just watching the book become obsolete as we were writing it. It was incredible. It was very fun. I don't recommend it.
Well, much like how technology is, I heard this trope one time that technology is obsolete as soon as it hits the shelves. I don't know if that's an accurate analogy to what you were describing, but yeah.
No, that's perfect. That's totally, yeah, that's exactly what we were dealing with.
That's totally.
Oh,
totally
dang. That's also brutal.
Yeah.
We have
obviously
this idea.
We should.
You go.
I was just going to say, obviously, we should have followed Foucault's pattern and write about something that happened 200 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah.
we have this idea that I don't know if we're going to do, but I still kind of want to, where we want to do a lecture where we go through the book and point out everything that was true when the book was written that is no longer true.
That would be awesome. That would be
cool. And I mean, I think this is something that people do in the, like, 10th anniversary reprint of their book.
Right.
But
yeah.
The thing is, the things we are writing about change so quickly that you really can go back and say a year later, here's what changed in 12 months.
Right.
For sure. So the byline of the book is An Impertinent Field Guide to Modern Surveillance. And I found that the book holds true to, like, the designation of field guide, and that it aims mostly to, like, describe and analyze and all that stuff. However, like, is there any, like, implied call to action in the inspection house, or any sort of question that you're asking the reader to wrestle with, other than the ones that you already said?
I mean, I think Tim had covered this really well when he talked about letting the reader sit in the ambiguity. But I do think that looking at the panopticon metaphor, and whether or not what Foucault was describing and what Bentham was imagining are the right metaphor for what we're seeing now, is something to keep in mind. I think I also would like readers to think about other words and metaphors that are used in this kind of universe. So a word like security, for instance, which seems pretty simple on the face of it, but is actually incredibly elastic and can be used as a justification for any number of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a super polluted word to my mind as well. So, yeah. I
mean, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, your mind, yeah, and probably to most of your listeners' minds, but it's still common currency in political discourse, right?
For sure.
Like, security continues to be not quite a trump card, but pretty close to a trump card when you're trying to get new, increasingly weird laws passed. And, I mean, part of what we found so fascinating, right, like starting with the sort of cautionary tale of Bentham, like, it's easy to assume that all of your political opponents are doing it for bad reasons. And there is certainly the case that there are a lot of people who are, there's like, yes, corruption exists and disingenuousness exists and a willingness to use words incorrectly or to like use words that are not what you really mean. All of those things are certainly a key part of a certain kind of political process. And at the same time, like, I generally came to believe that most of the people that we cover who are, like, implementing really brutal systems really did think that they were making the world a better place, right? Like, there's a long section where we look at the guy who was in charge of security in the city of London, sort of at the height of IRA aggression. And he's proud of securing the city of London against the IRA. Like, they completely rewrote how traffic worked. They, like, used a bunch of laws that were not meant to be used in this, in order to, like, build the security network. And then they put cameras everywhere, and then they sort of sit into their thing. And the result is this now incredibly comprehensive surveillance network that suffuses London, which then gets used in all kinds of dangerous ways around, like, policing protest and other kinds of civil disobedience and whatever else, right? So built in response to real things that happened. People were actually bombing buildings, but then continues to live on long past the threat ending. But this guy, like, is genuinely proud of his work, right? He had these problems, and he worked really hard on solving them, and he really thinks that what he built made a better, safer place. That's a different kind of political opponent than one who is just, like, out to pillage the common good on the way to profit. And both of those kinds of political opponents exist, but the ones who mean well... they're the scarier ones, I think.
That's totally on the real. Y'all are on tour now, right?
Yeah, as of next week, we will be.
How can people find out more about where y'all are going to be and or a date? So is there a website or anything like that?
So the best place to go to is our publisher's website, which is Coach House Books. Mm-hmm. CHBooks.com is their name. We are at this point doing two events in Toronto on the 23rd and 24th, mm-hmm. and an event in Peterborough, Ontario at Trent University.
Cool. It's a very short tour.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did a tour in the States in the fall, and then this is our triumphant return to Canada.
How did the States tour go? Was it good?
Yes.
That's awesome.
We had a wonderful time at Red Emma's.
Thank you guys so much for talking. It's been a blast.
It's been fun.
Thanks
it was
again
nice.
for getting yeah. in touch with us.
We've been speaking with Emily and Tim about their book, The Inspection House, which is available through the Coach House Books Exploded Views series. You can see more about this book and learn more about their upcoming Canadian tour by visiting chbooks.com/catalog/inspection-house. Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Thanks for tuning in, and see you next week.